Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Higher Dimension. I'm your hostess for the evening, and this evening we have a lovely, lovely guest, Judith Stockman. She is a wonderfully gifted intuitive. She is a lovely lady. She's written a couple of books called 2012, and it's about the fourth dimension. And also, the second book is Plan ET. I've just finished reading them. I was under the gun to get them read so I could talk intelligently tonight with her. So, welcome to our show, my dear. How are you?
Thank you so much. I have been looking forward to this, Phyllis. I am most grateful that, you know, you have included me in your program.
Well, you're a delightful lady. Would you please tell our listeners a little something about yourself?
Well, I'm a Californian.
Okay.
Basically.
But you're not
even
there now.
But I haven't been there in about 20 years. I'm living on the East Coast now.
Okay.
And when I was in California, I went to USC. I was in public relations. I was a model.
Wow. You were a model.
Yes, in the days when they did not have supermodels, when it was a very simplistic industry.
What type of modeling did you do?
Basically commercials. I was with Nina Blanchard, who was affiliated with Eileen Ford at that time.
Okay.
But
okay.
It was a whole different chemistry, so to speak.
Yes.
And there were only about 30 individuals with each agency.
Oh, really?
Yes, it was. We had cattle calls, of course. You know, we're hundreds from every agency in town. Show up, and you meet one another, and you make friends, so to speak, while you're waiting there an hour or two.
Yes.
And it was wonderful. It was kind of the golden age, so to speak, in which there wasn't a high infiltration, let's say, of drugs and whatever.
Yes.
You know, there was alcohol, of course,
but always.
But it was basically a simpler time
in
the era of America, so to speak,
because
I'm going back to the
60s. We're not going to go how that far back. Well, if you are, I'm going to have to sneak in there, too. I did photographic modeling for my dad and his friends. They were amateur photographers.
Oh, what fun.
Hey, Daisy. And hello.
I'm here.
Okay. Wow, that was a real live sleep in the air. Anyway, it was wonderful. And so I imagine you had a lot of fun.
It was. It was really delightful. Many artistic people, you know, it was photographers and artists and fashion designers, and it was delightful. And then after that, became kind of nomadic.
Okay.
And later married and had two children.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband's profession involved a lot of travel. And then when he passed away...
Would you tell them who your husband was?
My husband was Warren Oates, who was an character actor. And Warren died in 1982. And at that time, I took my two very young children, ages 2 and 3, to New Zealand. I had lived in New Zealand before, and I enjoyed it very much. I have enormous respect for the people of that country. They, I found actually living in a socialistic country for 2 years plus an absolute, you know, delight. The attitude of the people there, they are so accepting. You know, it was kind of hard for me to adjust to the mentality in a certain way, because we as Americans like to find fault. We like to say, okay, the house burnt down, and let's see who's responsible and who are we going to sue. Whereas the New Zealanders seriously say, okay, the house burnt down, we will get together with our friends, we will find a way to make these adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not done with anger or frustration or trying to find who's responsible because things just happen sometimes.
Mm.
They're very easygoing. When I took my children to birthdays at their homes, the birthday parties were usually not to celebrate the child who was having the birthday. It was to celebrate the fact that they had friends. And so the friends were honored. And I found that, you know, if a window broke, they would stuff clothing or, depending upon their socioeconomic status, they would find a way, whereas we have to have a certain formula. If the window breaks, we have to replace it with a window. But yet they were much more resilient, so to speak. And I found them so refreshing, so honest, so giving. And it was truly, you know, one of those life-altering situations when you live in another country.
So how long did you stay in New Zealand?
Basically over 2 years. And, and it was really funny because I seriously was thinking of immigrating and, you know, staying there permanently. Mm-hmm. And I had very good friends there that were, actually lived on another island. But then there came a point in time where I wanted to come back to the United States. And, you know, I felt that it was, since my children had been born here, that it was, that they're, let's say that it was important for them to come back, you know.
I understand.
Yeah, but it was a beautiful time.
So you have moved through your life. How did you come to be involved in the fourth dimension, into psychic phenomena, all of this?
Well, when I was in college, I was very interested in comparative religion. And my dad was an atheist.
Interesting.
But he made me go to church every Sunday, at least twice.
Yeah,
that's the irony of it.
Yeah.
My mother, her parents were from Wales. And, of course, you know, the Welsh are very much into the fairies and, you know, the spirits. And she believed in reincarnation. And actually, because born in 1943, I actually lived with my mother and my grandfather, Papa, who was a Welsh immigrant, and his brother, who was a Welsh minister, the first 5 years of my life. So my biography is totally different than my sister's or my brother's, who, you know, with this 7 and 11 year separation that I had with them. And so that was kind of an introduction, too. And then, of course, living in Los Angeles, which is so eclectic, and you have these incredible exposures of friends from all forms of, you know, spiritual teachings and faith systems. Somehow, it was about the time that Thelma Moss was bringing Curly and photography to America. And I think she was very involved at UCLA. And, of course, the number of psychics in Los Angeles, you know, it was they were abundant. And later in my, I guess it was my late 20s, I connected with a woman who was an artist. And she hosted many soirees, so to speak, where many of her friends were either healers or psychics. And, you know, often Warren and I would go to many of the events and enjoyed the, you know, socialization and their perceptions enormously. But the irony was, it wasn't until Warren died that I had the question. And it was very important to me to speak to someone shortly thereafter. And I said, what is it? Because Warren had six planets in Cancer. He was very, very intuitive. He was hoarding gold and burying it throughout the house and whatever. And, of course, he showed me where it was once, and then I never remembered. And he also had purchased some property in Montana, and he felt that that would be a beautiful refuge for people should times go into any type of rebellion, or the, if people lost their homes or whatever, you know, that he wanted that type of preparedness. But then when he died, I asked someone to come over, and I said, what is it that I feel is at the turn of the century, and I can't identify it, but, you know, can you help me? And he said, yes. He said, I want you to read Edgar Cayce. He said, you know, you'll find your answer there. And so I did.
So you're like me.
And
you found Edgar Cayce, and that helped a lot.
It helped so much. And then the interesting thing was, of course, that tied in with why I went to New Zealand.
Ah, okay. Okay. Did you ever experience fourth dimensional shifts yourself, or see UFOs or anything of that nature? Had visits, anything of that nature?
Well, I think when Warren died, I heard a voice beckoning, and my dogs reacted to that, and they, you know, all of the hair on their bodies was stand up. As huskies, it's quite evident.
Right.
And they started howling. I lived in a haunted house when I was first in L.A., and that was very interesting because actually Warren was my neighbor. It was Robert Vaughn was in the real house. I had the property where a house was built on the tennis court, and Warren, many years later, bought the property which was the pool house. And it had a little cottage on it that was put together by hookers and bartenders on weekends, and it was absolutely charming. It was such a delight. And it was, you felt so warm and so happy when you were inside it, but the history of how it was built I thought was so funny.
That is cute.
And so it wasn't built for him, you know, it had been built for the previous owner, which I thought was so funny. And so the property that I was on, people would not be comfortable. They would basically leave, including my sister on many an occasion. And then she found it very interesting and would bring friends over to see this phantom-like creature who would appear. But the irony was because you could hear sounds, you could feel the cold, you could see an ectoplasmic figure. My animals always reacted to it. Is that basically it's an interpretation. This individual or spirit was actually only appeared in times in which I could have been prevented from certain accidents.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, but I think he also,
he, so go with your intuition.
I think it's a he.
It was a male.
Liked to play tricks on my company. You know, rearrange their suitcases, whatever. But, you know. But for me, I think basically I was, one of the things that I did when I was a model is that at that time Catalina had, which was a swimsuit company, had many commercials. And this was very popular in the 60s and the early 70s.
Right.
We worked with wild animals.
Yes.
And so it was during this time that I had an early call in Malibu, and I was to wear a leopard print bikini, and I was to work with a leopard. And the on the way through Malibu, they, you know, they made the tunnel in a way that the animals could not get down to the creek. In other words, the road went straight through, you know, their natural path. So I was coming out of the tunnel. I hit a deer with a he was so beautiful. The impact killed him immediately. Ironically, there was a policeman behind, and I, you know, there was no way of saving it. But when I went to the job, I said, you know, is there a way in which the animal can feel that I am upset? I would assume that it could. And they said, oh, no, you'll be fine. And the cat hammerlocked my leg. And I said, what does this mean? Because this cat had actually slept with the owner's six-year-old daughter. He was that tame. And so we started to shoot, and the cat threw me to the ground, and I had my hands thinking that I could open the jaws of the leopard, which I couldn't. And so he had my hands and my leg. And the gun, the tranquilizer gun, was actually parked about a block away, so I said, is there anything that you can do? And I had definitely an out-of-body experience. I mean, I was not feeling any pains at that moment. And I just said, what can you do? Because the camera wasn't even rolling. Everyone was frozen. They were all, so much in shock. And so they tried to break his leg, which...
That would only make him angrier.
Right. And so he went into another place. And so ultimately they put pressure on his throat, and I got my hands and my leg up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you still carry the scars?
Yes, but they're so minimal. I mean, I had a great plastic surgeon, and but the irony was, when I was in the hospital, they said, oh, you'll never, you know, at first they thought they might have to amputate because of the sand and the just everything. That didn't happen. Then they said I would never walk normally.
Okay.
And I think a year later I was trekking in the Himalayas.
Wow.
But the beauty was, because my life had been rather unscathed, I was in with cancer patients. I was in with amputees. I saw courage.
Mm-hmm.
I was exposed to an element or a segment of society
mm-hmm.
that I very much needed to come into contact with, because my health had always been blissfully okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was, I'm very grateful for that experience.
Well, that's phenomenal. I'm not sure I would have been quite as calm and cool and collected under the similar circumstances.
Oh, and then the funny thing was, my attorney said, now whatever you do, because I was so much involved with wildlife, you know, and he said, now don't you dare think of doing any of your active, you know, letters and whatever of trying to save this species and that species. And, of course, you know, as soon as I was given pen and paper, I was trying to save the pumas in California. You know? Life goes on, and
right.
What you want to do goes on.
Right. I hear you. I hear you. So what brought you, then, to this wonderful book, these two books? And I think you have a third one at least coming. At least that's how I perceived it.
I am trying to, yeah, hopefully it might be out about this time next year.
Okay. Okay.
And so what happened? Right? How did
yes. It well, let me say, how did you get drawn to write this, these two stories? And this, is it going to be a trilogy or is it going to be...
It's going to be a trilogy.
Okay.
Yeah. And actually, the last book is my favorite.
Okay. Okay.
But what happened was, I had a life reading many, many years mm-hmm. ago by a gentleman by the name of Aaron Abrahamson.
Yes, he was on our show
yes.
in January, yes.
Yes, and Aaron was always very active with the ARE and whatever, mm-hmm. and he had been recommended to me. And Aaron said in a reading that mm-hmm. I would write 7 little golden books.
Ah.
And whatever, you know, I no longer have the tape because I'm such a nomad. I have no idea mm-hmm. where anything is anymore.
Right.
I'm sure it's scattered around the country. But I kind of, that's the only thing I really remember from the reading. And
okay.
I thought, gosh, this is something, because I am going to be 65 this summer. And I thought, when is this ever going to happen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, fortunately, my lifestyle kind of changed with my work, which allowed me a little bit more freedom. And I thought, if I can write evenings and weekends and every spare
mm-hmm.
moment and not jeopardize my work,
mm-hmm.
maybe that could happen. And so that was the initial thing. But the irony was, I was with a little boy
mm-hmm.
who was 10 years old, and his mother said, I'm going to try homeschooling and see how that goes for a while, because a friend of mine, you
mm-hmm.
know, absolutely adores it, and her children gravitate towards it. And she knew that it may or may not work, because it's an incredible experience, but sometimes, depending upon the child, it's socially alienating.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it can be.
You know,
yes, it can be.
Yeah. So I started working with Jai, and I said, what is it you would, because I'm a Waldorf teacher. I went
okay.
to the Steiner, you know,
yeah,
program.
Yes, I've done something like that, and I've worked in developing something that's similar to Waldorf, but a little bit different. But go ahead.
Oh, I'd love to hear
my that. My son, his first schooling was in a Rudolf Steiner school in Arlington, Virginia.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And so you've taken it another step.
Yes. Yeah, well,
that's great. That's very imaginative.
Yeah, it was actually the way I was raised. But let's get back to you.
Okay.
This is incorporated.
So what my mother said, I said, all right, what type of curriculum?
Yes.
You know, because the thing is, I've, you know, tutored in public school
right.
and different methods. And I thought, you know, whatever you want is the way it should be.
Right.
She said, he'll tell you.
I said, yes.
Okay, that's going to be interesting.
Okay.
And so he said, I would like to study every form of mythology. And he said, I want to see if there's any interconnection.
And how old was he?
10.
Okay.
And I said, okay, we can do that. So let's start out with the Norse myths, and then we'll go to the Greek, and then we'll go to the Roman, because they had fun changing names, you know.
Yes.
And we can see if there's similarities
mm-hmm.
or what the contrasts are. And
mm-hmm.
then he became very, very interested in astronomy. But then the interest in astronomy became mingled with astrology.
Okay.
And then his family was going to take a trip to the Grand Canyon.
Right.
And he said, I want to know about the indigenous people in the Grand Canyon. So that opened up another door so that we started
mm-hmm.
Not learning so much about what did they eat or what
mm-hmm.
did they wear or how did they catch their fish.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, I want to know what their feeling life was like.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, well, then they have stories. Too. They
mm-hmm.
have, you know, their
stories, creation myths, and so forth.
Exactly. And so we had the most incredible time, and then there came a point in time around January where the mother called and she said, you know, I think from, she said, I can't do this anymore. She said,
really?
She said, I have no freedom. And she said, and I think Jai actually misses being with his peers. And I said, you know, that could very well be. I miss that time with him so much, and I thought, why does it have to end? Why don't
mm-hmm.
I, you know, start to tell the story of what we learned together, but in another way, because there might be other, you know, children out
mm-hmm.
there who might gravitate towards the same subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's kind of how it happened. And you know, also, Phyllis, this could have not been done if the Internet did not exist.
Right. I noticed all the research you did. I do thumb through the books front and back, darling, when I start to review them with people. I do pay attention, trust me.
Oh, I know. You're so good to take the time and do that. I mean, that's quite a commitment, my gosh. Thank you so much.
Well, you're quite welcome. It's my pleasure.
But, so I started writing, and then it was really interesting. I started seeing the similarities, because I've always taken Gordon Michael Scallion's
mm-hmm.
Newsletters, and I have his book Notes from the Cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, my gosh, there's so much that is in, you know, that's compatible. So I started writing a little story about his predictions, because
mm-hmm.
I only kept certain editions over a period of maybe 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, why is it that I've only kept these?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's because it had the theme that it was somehow really significant about 2012.
Okay.
So I wrote him, and I just said, is it okay if I, you know, use quote some of these things? And he's such a generous, considerate person, and
mm-hmm.
he said, you know, definitely. So I wrote him, I sent him 3 chapters, and he said, don't send any more until it's, you know, you have the final edition. He was very, very helpful on guidance. He said, self-publish.
Mm-hmm.
He said, it is so hard in today's market, you know, to find someone, because they can keep a manuscript anywhere from 6 months to a year. And
wow.
I'm too old.
I'll yeah,
be 90
to wait
by the
that.
Time I get an answer of 3 rejections.
Right.
So I said, okay, I will send you the final book when it's through. And he
mm-hmm.
was so sweet. He said that he would, you know, put
mm-hmm.
it on my on his website. And yeah, so he was incredibly, incredibly
mm-hmm.
supportive. Because I think what he realized, too, is that we have so many books out for adults.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that this is your typical young adult story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it starts out, both books start out very simple, and then they escalate.
Yeah.
Significantly. But you know, if we go on what John Major Jenkins has said about
mm-hmm.
the sunspots,
yeah.
And the cycle that we're in, and the McKenna brothers talking about the I Ching, and with the sunspots and this unusual radiation that's going to be coming in, which will convert the melatonin, which is naturally made in your body in the third eye, to DMT, mm-hmm. then that will affect our consciousness.
Okay, why don't you talk to them about this, because I'm not familiar with the I Ching and the you're making assumptions that I have some knowledge that you don't have, that I don't have. Okay.
Well,
talk about the I Ching and the brothers
okay.
and sisters, okay?
Okay, well, this is actually part of the research towards the finale, the third book. And what I came across was the sunspot cycle that we're going into. Now, many people feel that sunspots are actually like a vortex.
Okay, now I know that from what I've read, there is a 11-year cycle.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Where of activity on the sun. Where it, and now we're coming into a heavier.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken.
Quite dramatic.
Okay,
and,
go ahead.
And it has to do with the precession of the equinoxes, too, which is like
okay.
a 26,000 year
yes. okay.
cycle. So what happens is it changes our angular orientation to the larger magnetic field of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
So then our magnetic shield as a planet becomes unstable and it oscillates. And it allows greater amounts of mutational rays to strike the Earth's surface.
Mm-hmm.
So when we have an alignment like this, we as humans and also the animals are exposed to higher doses of high-frequency radiation. And what the assumption is that basically the junk DNA or
mm-hmm.
the massive amount of genes, which we have no idea what they are.
You at know, this moment in time.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So here you have the pineal gland, or the third eye, and
mm-hmm.
it converts melatonin to make DMT.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the assumption that that's the very thing that's going to cause the evolutionary quantum leap,
is
which
it?
Gordon Michael Scallion and others, you know, talk
mm-hmm.
about. But then we get into the time wave theory, which is
mm-hmm.
part two. So the Chinese I Ching, Book of Changes, has
mm-hmm.
a mathematical code, and the McKenna brothers actually experienced through the guidance of a shaman and hallucinogenic
mm-hmm.
drugs
mm.
an experience which altered them, and they came back and they worked with mathematicians and scientists
mm-hmm.
to see if there could be any potential to this revelation or this experience that they had while away. And this is basically how what happened. They took the I Ching, and it has peaks and lows of history, and they lined them up. And at the end of the wave, when all the subwaves peak, actually ended up to be 2012. And what they did was a graphical depiction of the process,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which describes the ebb and flow of novelty. So novelty phenomenon is the basis for the creation and conservation of higher ordered states of complex forms in nature. So it's like a universal connectedness that starts
mm-hmm.
happening. Now, the opposite of novelty is habit or routine or the conventional.
Mm-hmm.
And novelty is always new and revolutionary understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So what they found was, and at first they had a mathematical error, and then they found that they were wrong, and then they went back and corrected it.
Okay, now let me go back and say, I Ching, I thought, was a form of fortune-telling. You threw sticks.
You know,
all I know is
it's a book of changes, but I have never,
okay.
I have to tell you, I haven't read it.
Okay, because I had seen it sometime. And
oh, have you?
Yes, and that's it may be a book of changes, but they used it for telling prophecies and telling fortunes.
Ah.
That's what it was used for, and that's why I'm a little surprised that what you're telling me just is not within my experiential or learning curve at this point.
Well, the thing that I got out of it, and,
okay.
It was about 10 pages that I read on it,
okay,
is that they said that there have been three events that have changed the course of human history, and one was the agricultural revolution, the industrial, and of course, we're in the information, you know, revolution right now. And the mathematical model that they constructed, and they worked with professionals on this, you know, it wasn't just them, so to speak, that they saw approximately 61 more of these species-changing developments before the end of the Mayan calendar. And the interesting part was from December 15th to the 21st, in the last 135 minutes, 18 barriers comparable to the appearance of life or the invention of language will be crossed, and 13 of those will occur in the last fraction of a second. So, anyway, the research that they did, which is called the time wave, is really getting a lot of attention now, especially when you put it together with John Major Jenkins, you know, information about the sunspots creating the conversion of the naturally produced melatonin into DMT. So, you know, it could be very exciting.
It could be. And what do they think this will portend?
I'm sorry?
What? I'm sorry. Maybe I'm not asking the question right. The purpose is that with this is what's going to happen in 2012, that there will be a move into a higher dimension. Is that what I hear you saying?
According to, I think, the McKenna brothers, they anticipate that it actually will start before 2012.
Right.
They anticipate 61 changes, but the thing is, 18 of them will happen in the last week of December.
Okay.
In 2012.
After, it's a 2012, is that right?
It's 1221.
1221, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's a premise, and it's kind of a, you know, a, my gosh, it's a phenomenal premise, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see if it happens.
Yeah, I think so. I think
right.
so. So you've written this book, and it's geared toward teenagers, you say, though in some of the stories here, the children are younger.
In some of the, and then they age 3 years in the first book.
Okay, I was,
And then what happens is the second book, they're the same age. They're between early and mid-teens. And in the third book, they'll be in the same age group.
Mm.
And the first book is basically a lot of Gordon Michael Scallion's information, either from Intuitive Flash, his newsletter, or from Notes from the Cosmos, and American Indian projections or prophecies. And it's not just the Hopi who are the primary record keepers. It's infused a little bit with some of the Sioux, and the second book has some of the Cherokee prophecies of time, untime, which is such, they're so poetic, the American Indians. And they speak in such beautiful metaphors that sometimes it's very clear and sometimes it's not, but it makes you see images when, you know, you go over their writings. But, and so the first book has to do with preparedness. It has to do with what Gordon Michael Scallion foresees as the earth changes, which are a preparation for what he refers to as the age of intuition, and the American Indians refer to as the fifth age of the age of illumination. And the second book was actually inspired from the works of Zechariah Sitchin, who is an incredible genius, and has 14 books, which are 500 pages each.
Oy.
Will definitely convince you that we have perhaps been genetically altered by an extraterrestrial race.
Well, this I had heard, you know, at some other point in time. So that's not so strange. But basically, your book seems to have so much information in it that it can be confusing. Okay?
It's true. I will agree with you on that.
Okay. It was like a compendium. Like a lot of information was given and compressed.
Well, you know what happens when you self-publish?
Okay.
The price of the book is determined by the number of pages.
Really?
Yeah. So every time I jump 10 pages after, you know, a certain amount, because the price of the books now, I think, are $18.
Wow.
And I wanted it to be $14.
Uh-huh.
But basically, if it's sold through Amazon, I would make like $1.33.
Oh, that's not enough.
So you see, I'm really not I am not the recipient, so to speak. And so I tried to keep it, you start making choices. In other words, I could have come across with, how can I say this, maybe 15 or 20 focuses, you know, in the 160 pages.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, when I was going, when I was studying to be a Waldorf teacher, one of the things that I truly enjoyed about reading Steiner, who was very, very difficult to read.
Well, I didn't think he was that difficult.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
My grade school, which was the grade school for Catholic University, was developed by a, was developed originally by a priest. Who had studied or been taught by Steiner's daughter way back when.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. He had tried to set it up. It's very strange. It's very interesting, isn't it?
That is very unusual.
Yes,
yeah. That he would be so accepting and open.
Yes, unfortunately, the pastor of the school church in town, he set it up and the pastor disagreed with it. So he was asked to leave that school, and so he went to the grade school of Catholic University, and they gave him the opportunity to try and illuminate this teaching in the Catholic traditional school.
Oh, my goodness.
It's fascinating the way things happen in this.
That is.
But, yeah, I was trying to get more of your experiences in here, and the things that you are proposing, your ideas of extraterrestrial help coming from those who are around waiting to help. Is that correct?
I think so. Well, you know, going back to the thing with Steiner, the one thing I loved about his books is that I would get one thing I have never heard, ever considered before.
Okay.
So when I started to write the books, I thought, now this could be plausible.
Okay.
It's not that I am 100% for anything. It's wide spectrum. But also, you read three pages. If you don't like that subject, it goes to
something else.
Yeah. So in other words, you're not stuck in it too long. And that's part of the confusion, but that's also part of the exposure and the choice.
Do the children that you see coming up today have more difficulty in concentrating and staying with the subject?
Well,
do you think?
I have tutored up. Most of the children I've been tutoring have Asperger's. And they have IQs of 160.
Right. They're very bright children.
Incredibly bright. And they also have ADD and ADHD.
Go ahead.
And I'm currently a house parent at a therapeutic boarding school where we have a lot of different conditions here. And they're here primarily because they've had difficulties, you know, in one way or another in their teenage years. But I find them very incredibly intellectually bright.
Is it because they're not teaching them up to their mental capacity, so they have a different mode or method of learning that is outside of our own structured formal educational?
I definitely think that a lot of their needs, which can't even be described, and I'm not talking about the boarding school so much as younger children that I have been tutoring, which are now, you know, like 10, 11, 12. There's a thirst. I mean, a real anguish going on. It's amazing to me. In the public school system, everyone complains and they say, okay, I'm so bored when I teach them. In the private school system, which the tuition is about $25,000 a year.
Right.
Which, I'm talking about kids in the third, fourth grade, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Basically, the homework is identical. How it's taught, if it's inspirational within the classroom, I can't make that judgment. I don't attend the classes. I just do the homework with them.
Right.
There's something that they're looking for, which is I would put even on a soul basis. It has nothing to do with intelligence. It has to do with the fact that somehow the exposure to other elements in life, whether you qualify it as philosophical, an attitude to life, I don't want to necessarily say it has to be religious or spiritual, but there are questions that they have where they don't feel like they have a foundation to begin with. Okay? In other words, where is the basement? You know, and then the first floor or whatever. But that they feel a little bit as if everything is without wonder. You know, or everything is just becoming really kind of mechanical as opposed to being infused with a lot of incredible awe. I don't know. What has your experience been? Because I know you've had teaching, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess what I've done, I've worked with children who have been from the worst section of D.C., in an attempt to get them to open up to being wanting to study, and they have little or no discipline whatsoever, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I found it, well, I don't know whether it's just force of personality, but I used my methodology of music and scent and touch and breath work and found that the kids calm down, and once you get their attention, then you can get them to work.
I think you're right.
And I was able to, using this five-sensory approach with kids, even in the after-school programs, to get them to calm down, and even to the point of we fed the children, because some of them didn't get really good meals.
Okay.
A lot of them, their parents were drug addicts.
So critical.
Yeah, and so I also, when I went in, made some suggestions about the food that they were serving them. I said, this, and this is the kind of food that will get them, you know, up and jiving. You don't want them up and jiving. You want them calm so you can get them to do the work.
Right.
So they started taking my word and, you know, started feeding them a little bit better, giving them more fruits and vegetables, definitely, and fresh fruit rather than, you know, canned fruit, that type of thing, and not so much the sweet sodas as fresh fruit juice or something of that nature.
Yeah.
But I found that, I don't know whether what it is I do, sometimes I just, quite frankly, go in mentally and talk to the child in the mind. I just go in and just tell them to calm down, and I don't know whether it's mental telepathy or what, but I have always been able to reach children that way and, you know, get them to change their behavior. But I also find that using, you know, music, scent, et cetera, works very, very well.
Harp, I think you're totally right.
You know, harp and violin music, piano and harp. Piano, violin, that type of thing, played softly, will get them to calm down. After a while, the minute they walk in, you can see them. It's like a light switch being turned off and on. You see them calming down without any effort whatsoever. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
And
you created the ideal atmosphere.
Yeah, the only thing is I cannot stand in a situation where they have concrete walls, which is what they did in this place.
Oh,
I couldn't stay there very long because I began to get headaches from the reverberation of sound. I couldn't tolerate it, you know. But the children would respond very positively to that environment. And they would concentrate longer, and they would do better. They got their homework done faster and got it done right.
I believe you.
Yeah.
Yeah, because once you provide the ideal environment in which it allows them to relax,
to be themselves, actually.
And to focus. You know, I read an article once that said that children with ADD, ADHD, if you remove refined sugar and also wheat from their diet, and it's amazing how many individuals today
have
a condition, have a celiac.
Yep.
The gluten allergy.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, if parents ever have blood work done on their children, that's a very important thing to discover, is if they are, you know, allergic to gluten.
You know what? You also gain weight with it.
With gluten.
Yeah. I've become allergic to gluten. I've recently started removing a lot of it out of my diet. And quite frankly, I started losing 5 pounds a week, added chromium, too, by the way, and started losing very quickly. And to me, that my doctor became hysterical. First, he said, "You're not losing fast enough." And I started losing. He said, "No, you're losing too fast." I said, "Make up my mind for me. You know, give me a break already.
You know,
listen. Give me a break, you know? Come on." So,
yeah, well, my daughter also has celiac.
Okay.
And she said, "I want you to go in and be tested." So I did, and she was so disappointed that I wasn't the genetic one. But, you know, I also told her on the research that sometimes it can be caused by stress.
It also, absolutely. Also, you might check if there is a weight issue with your daughter, check and see if she would be, it would be appropriate to start giving her GTF chromium. It is a replacement for that which converts the sugar in the blood to energy. Because when you have a lack of it, what happens is whatever you eat, irrespective of anything else, it isn't absorbed by the tissues of the body but goes straight into fat. And then your body secretes more insulin in order to try and get you the energy you need, because it's not being absorbed, and then eventually it leads to diabetes, because that's when your pancreas overproduces insulin.
My gosh, well, that's very helpful. I just wrote that down. She will know about that tonight.
it's very interesting. I have found it a few months ago, and I've been steadily losing weight without being on too strict a diet, for which I am profoundly grateful. Because I happen to enjoy food. My stepfather was Italian.
Me too.
My stepfather was Italian. What can I tell you? I enjoy food. he was a good cook. for that matter, it's a wonderful situation. And if you just watch what you eat and, removing the wheat, gluten, et cetera, and the other chromium, and just putting more veggies and hydrates in equal portion in the meals you eat, you'd be amazed how your body responds. And if you go off of that diet, your body immediately responds by telling you it doesn't feel good when you try to put stuff that you shouldn't eat back in.
Mm-hmm.
You'll start feeling nauseous and sick with what you have.
Mm.
So your body itself says, "Yo, wait a minute, I really like the way it was, huh?"
Because you're detoxifying.
Yes.
So you start responding to the purity of certain tastes, which is very hard in life, because usually everything is so intermingled with ingredients that we can't even wonder what they might be.
You gotta watch what you're eating, babes.
I know.
You know, you gotta watch what you're eating, and then it works.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what I found. But at any rate, a lot of the information from our readers, here, listen to me. A lot of information. This book is very interesting. It provides a lot of information. Both of the books do. I would not suggest that you romp through it like I did. I had an ulterior motive, that is, to get as much read as possible so I could speak to the young lady intelligently. So I could move around. I liked the second book and found it better written. It was more comprehensive and cohesive to me than the first book. That's all I can tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I did, it just, maybe it's just different style that I'm used to, and I have to say that too.
You do.
But I enjoyed
so
the book. I did enjoy the book. I think it has, both of them have a great deal of information. Great, and I have to say you've done your research, honestly. And I can't gainsay, you know, I think that is fabulous. Okay? It's all interesting information, ladies and gentlemen. And tell them how they can get those books if you wish to at this moment.
They can go to my website, which I suggest going through Google, because I have MSN, and it totally leads me to a, oh, my gosh, some type of bird site.
Oh, lovely.
Which, you know, it says, you know, the seagulls will be arriving or something.
Oh, wonderful.
But go through Google, and you'll find about 10 places where you can connect with it.
Okay.
And the website is Manda, M-A-N-D-A, 2012.com.
Okay.
And Manda is the name that, basically the pseudonym that I write and my children write under,
mm-hmm.
because we always felt, Manda means knowledge. It's an old Aramaic word, and it just means knowledge. Knowledge is to share. It does not involve ownership. So we say that we are assimilators, researchers, but we are not the authors. The authors are in the footnotes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So all we did was invent some characters and a little bit of a story to make it a little bit more palatable. But, you know, one reason why I think the first book is harder is it has a lot of scientific information. It tells you right where we are right now as far as interpretation of things and where there may be conflict or there may be actual support of, you know, metaphysical theories. It's like in the third book, I'm going to get into the holographic universe, you know, the string theories, all of these things, which the fifth element, which are highly, highly compatible with science.
Have you ever seen that which is between matter, the wave and the particles?
I don't think so.
If you go into a soft meditation, you can see it. Every once in a while, I did. One time I saw it, I said, what the? And the next thing I knew, I saw waves and particles moving in the air, and I said, now I know these are not dust motes. But you can move into a meditative phase and actually see the waves and the particles on the waves of which that which is between matter is made up. It's fascinating.
Is that kind of what you see when there's bright sunlight?
Sort of, but not quite, because that's
but not the same,
That's not the same. This is like a wave. It's like watching a liquid wave.
Ooh.
Okay, and there are just little, they're much smaller than the motes and particles you would see if you were looking at a sunbeam. Okay?
Oh my.
But it is literally wave-like. It reminded me very much on the shore, and I said, now why is there water in the air? And then it dawned on me there wasn't any water in the air. I was thinking, oh, I would have been drowning, you know.
Yeah.
Just like I don't breathe underwater real well. most of us don't these days. Irrespective of where we may have come from in the past. But anyway, if you go into a meditative state and just relax your eyes, that's the only way I can explain it, you can see it.
Oh, my God.
It's fascinating.
I will have to try that.
Oh, yeah, it's easy.
Yeah.
Once you get into it, see, we can do so much more than we believe we can if we allow ourselves to know that we can do it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
We have to give ourselves permission to know that we can do all sorts of things and not put a restriction on it.
That's right.
But
positive thinking.
your book, books I found instructive, and I am interested in reading your third book, by the way.
Oh,
yeah.
And you have to do it very slowly. I almost sent you a note and to say
slow down, don't swallow.
You should
early.
Read like 5 to 6 pages. But of course, I got these to you so late. So
mm-hmm.
You were amazingly courageous to do it. You did.
Well, you know, a lot of it I'm familiar with. And I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with a lot of this. But you've put it in a form that's more like a story. But it's just, I know a great deal of information that I found interesting. And I was wondering how children, have you had any of your kids read it? Or have you introduced it to the kids at school? See how they accept it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The book 2 is now okay. I mean, it is now available.
Right. Yeah.
Book 1, they didn't do the colors correctly.
Oh, dear.
And I thought, well, as long as they didn't do the colors correctly, I'm going to make 5 changes to the manuscript. So book 1 will actually be totally available in like 2 weeks.
Okay.
After these, I shouldn't have been so, but I love color.
Yeah.
And I thought, I want to get the colors right.
Well, you're entitled if you're paying for
it. So the thing is, because all I've been dealing with are, you know, the copies that they send me. No, I have not given it to anyone at the school. However, the student body where I am, the kids are anywhere from 15 to 18, and they have expressed an interest. However, I'm sure if they read it, I would be fired following, you know, the next day.
Why?
But
yes.
What's fascinating to me is that my children, my daughter is now 29, my son is going to be, well, he's 27 right now, but he'll be 28 shortly. They have many friends.
Oh, we're going to have to come to a stop. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Oh, Judy, thank you again.
Oh, thank you. I adored my time with
thank you. Thank you.
You are
I look
so kind
forward to talking
gracious.
To you again. And we have been listening to Judy Stockman. And she has the book, and she's given you her website information. Please, please, please go to it. I look forward to talking to you all again next week. God bless, and I'll talk to you soon personally, Judy. God bless
Thank
you, and good
you.
All good night. Thank you.